Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Vanished ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
Sometimes I'm like, how could I still have been so naive that this really wasn't going on? You clearly know people are capable of things you never thought they would be capable of because you lived it. But I also grew up in a home where no one talked about those things. And we lived our lives trying to do good for other people. The thought that people were actually out there doing this because that was what they chose to do just sort of was beyond my mind space. You know, there's a lot of guilt that I still feel because I can't believe that I so totally missed it.
On the evening of May 9th, 2009, just 9 days after she turned 18, Kelsey Collins left her home in Everett, Washington, to go visit a friend in Seattle, approximately 30 miles away. Kelsey was a radiant and smart young woman, but she was still young and somewhat naive. Kelsey never returned home that night or the next day, and the nearly 14 years of looking for her have spanned from teenage innocence and rebellion to the dark, nefarious, and ugly underworld of human and sex trafficking. What happened to Kelsey is a story that you've seen play out in media headlines before, but no two stories or victims are the same. Her disappearance is the final act in one of the most heinous crimes a person can commit, but her victimization at the hands of dangerous people is only part of her story. And though Kelsey's case has garnered some media attention, no one has shared an in-depth and comprehensive look at her life until now. I'm Marissa, and from Wondery, this is episode 377 of The Vanished, part one of Kelsey Collins' story, A New Name, A New Life. Audible offers thousands of popular favorites, exclusive new series, guided wellness programs, comedy, and exciting new voices in audio. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. The Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, doing chores, you decide. I like to listen a little bit each evening while I'm cooking dinner, and it's great for my evening walks too. Recently, I've been listening to Lay Them to Rest by Laura Norton. It's a fantastic audiobook. You don't want to miss it. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. That's audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. Before we get started, I wanted to mention that this week and next week's episodes contain more potentially traumatic information than most of our stories. If you choose to listen, you will hear detailed descriptions of adult subject matter, including violence, sexual assault, and exploitation. Please take care while listening. We would also like to mention that these episodes contain interviews with family members that discuss criminal proceedings. We would like to reiterate that anyone accused of a crime in the United States who has not pled guilty or been convicted of the alleged offense remains innocent until proven guilty in a court of law, with constitutional protections to a fair trial and due process. We hold no opinion about any person's innocence or guilt and are not qualified to give legal opinions or advice. Now on with the show. The day was Saturday, May 9th, 2009, and Kelsey's older sister Dominique was going to pay Kelsey for babysitting her children by braiding Kelsey's hair. There was nothing that stood out as unusual about Kelsey's behavior that day, but she did make a special request that Dominique was unsure about. Dominique told us about the last day she saw her sister and that request.
She had babysat my youngest, well, both of my girls for me, for whatever reason, I can't remember. And in exchange, I was going to braid her hair. And that's what I did. So I gave her, you know, a bunch of box braids or whatever. And God, it took hours. We did that. And then she was like, can you drop me off downtown? And I was like, that's odd. I was like, yeah, I can drop you off downtown. I was like, you got bus money? She's like, yeah, I got everything. And I said, okay, cool. And I said, well, what bus are you taking? And she, you know, laid out her route. And I was like, all right. And Leonard was like, my husband, Leonard, was like, you sure you want to drop her off downtown? I was like, I don't know. We've done it before. She, you know, she knows the bus system. She'll be fine. And that was the last time I saw her, was we dropped her off downtown, the big bus zone, tons of people down there. And I watched her walk off. She got to the bus and we drove off.
From what Kelsey's mom, Sarah, knew, Kelsey was going to see a movie with a friend, and she would take the bus or catch a ride from someone, which she had done in the past. Sarah explained what Kelsey told her plans were.
She went to go to a movie on May 9th. She was supposed to meet up with Brock, i.e. Hollywood, downtown. They were going to the movie at Westlake. There's a movie theater. They were going to go watch a movie in that area. I fell asleep and was taking a nap when she left. And when I woke up, she was gone. Her sister said, oh yeah, she left. She asked me for a bus fare before she left. So I gave her bus fare so she could get down there and get back if she needed to. But she's like, oh, Brock will bring me home.
Kelsey told Sarah that she was going to watch a movie in Westlake, a neighborhood in Seattle, about a half hour north of Everett where Kelsey lived, if you were traveling by car. Since Kelsey was taking the bus, the trip would have been much longer. Today, maps show that public transit from Everett to Westlake takes approximately 2 hours on average each way. We don't know if that has changed in the last 13 years, but it's important to note that Kelsey was planning to spend a significant amount of time traveling to her destination. And mass transit is frequently delayed, so it didn't necessarily seem strange to Sarah right away that Kelsey was late, and Kelsey had gone off on her own before. So the red flags that would usually stand out didn't, especially given that Kelsey was a freshly minted adult. Now she could do whatever she wanted, and that included choosing whether or not to come home. But Dominique told us that she knew this wasn't a normal day or two long of Kelsey rebelling against their mother when she got the phone call from her mom.
I remember that Sunday, my mom called me and she said, have you heard from Kelsey? And I was like, no, not since I dropped her off. And she's like, well, she hasn't come home. And again, in my head and out loud, I was like, okay, I don't get what the big panic is. And she's like, she hasn't come home. And I was like, what's going on? Because she always does this. This doesn't seem like it's a big of a deal. As soon as I answered the phone, I can tell you I was completely dumbfounded. I did not understand the panic that was on the other side of the phone. I was like, why is this a big deal? That was normal to me. I was like, okay, she'll be back in a few days. No, she didn't take her shoes. She didn't take her purse. She didn't take her brush. And I was like, wait a second. What's going on? What's the panic around this? Why is this such a big deal? And she was like, there's something I have to tell you. And that was when everything started to unfold. I was just finding everything out. And so I was getting hit with this barrage of information. That's when I found out she was a witness for, you know, Donna Coe Jackson's trial and Lisa Miles. And I was floored. I was angry. I was absolutely livid. And I certainly was not nice on the phone. And I just was like, why has no one even said anything to me about this? Why wasn't this discussed? I never would have dropped her off downtown. I never would have done A, B, C, D, and E. I wouldn't have let her testify. I wouldn't have done this. I was like, has anybody called Dad? And then I started bringing my dad into this, as if he could just magically do something. But I was reaching for something. I was reaching for answers. I was reaching for solutions. And, you know, that kind of when things kicked off and a complete panic, I think, set in for everybody. My mom was panicked. I was panicked.
Dominique was shocked to learn that her little sister was a witness in a sex trafficking case and that she had been kept in the dark about it until now. And now Kelsey was missing, just weeks after she had testified before a grand jury. We will dive into this aspect of the case more deeply later in the series. But for now, we're going to focus on these first few days after Kelsey vanished. Kelsey had taken a bus to meet a friend on May 9th, a Saturday. The next day was Mother's Day, and Sarah knew that Kelsey wouldn't miss that, despite some acrimony in their relationship. They had already made plans for the day.
The next day was Mother's Day, and we always did something for Mother's Day. And she didn't come home, and her phone was not turned on. I kept calling, and I kept going to voicemail. And her sister was like, I don't understand why she's not here. Because we talked about what we were going to do for Mother's Day. We were going to make a barbecue. At that point, I was like, it wasn't unusual if she spent the night at Brock's grandmother's house. Or that was the story I got. Brock was supposedly living with his grandmother. But I expected her to come home the next day. And she didn't. And she wouldn't answer her phone. And then the next Monday morning, I went to work. And she wasn't home, and I was worried, and I was trying to decide if I should go put in a police report. Then I went to work, and I got the call from my other daughter, and she said, Brock called, and he said she never showed up. She never showed up Saturday. So I came home and put in a police report. They basically, the only thing that gave them even a mild hiccup was I said, she just testified in a federal prosecution grand jury. And other than that, they were like, well, that's a little disturbing.
To say we were surprised to hear Sarah say that Kelsey was a key witness in a federal trial would be an understatement to say the least. That statement led us down a path that we never foresaw this case taking, but we had to follow the story. And it's a horrific tale that we have to remember is not simply a story, or an episode wrapped up into a neat 60-minute package and delivered to you for your entertainment. The stories we tell on The Vanished are real stories about real people, real victims, and real families. This is not entertainment. This is someone's lifelong nightmare. And our goal is to bring you all of Kelsey's story, not just the part that some would deem sensational. In order to do that, we have to hit rewind on Kelsey's life and go back to the beginning so that we can share with you how she came to be a federal witness in a major trafficking case with multiple defendants and many layers. So while we're going to go back in time to share Kelsey's entire story with you, keep the fact in your mind that Kelsey was only a child, 17 years old, until just days before her disappearance. That brings us to where we are picking up the story. And we're starting not at Kelsey's birth, though that will come later on. Instead, we chose to begin her story with an event we didn't quite know the importance of until we pieced her story together, but would become the major thread that forever impacted her life from the time she was in the early years of school. We first learn about this horrifying piece of information that we didn't expect to hear when we asked Sarah to give us the backstory of Kelsey's life. What unfolded from that single question would end up weaving Kelsey's story together into a cohesive perspective you will understand after you hear the second installment of Kelsey's story next week. So stick with us while we tell you the story of 18 years of Kelsey's life that encompasses more than most endure in their entire lifetime. You won't want to miss a second of it. In our interviews with Kelsey's mom, Sarah, and Kelsey's sister, Dominique, we learned so much. But as I just mentioned, it was one question we asked Sarah that we asked nearly every family member that set the scene. Tell us about the missing person's history. Here's Sarah.
We had escaped a really horrific domestic violence. She was about 4. And I always thought that maybe she got the least of it. But when she became a teenager, she was like almost worse than her sisters, who I'd already expected to have issues and problems with. One of the things that we realized when we testified against my ex-husband was we all remembered different pieces of the story. You know, there were things that stuck in each person's mind that
oftentimes the other person didn't remember, didn't know. My older two girls, my oldest one dealt with alcohol abuse. She's been sober for 6 years. I'm absolutely positive that a lot of that had to do with what happened to her as a teenager. And my second daughter, when Kelsey went missing, she blamed herself for not telling me what was going on. She had known a lot more than I did. And she got into drugs. And she has only been in recovery about 6 months. And Kelsey's been gone 13 and a half. Between what she went through as a kid and then losing her sister. And in a different way, I feel guilty because I was the one who said, you need to testify. And she felt guilty for not telling me all the things that she knew was really going on. Everything that could go wrong did go wrong. And she'd already had such a hard life to start. And I was the one who convinced her to testify. I told her, do you want other girls your age to go through what you're going through? And she said no.
We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there's no compromise. So don't settle for that one doctor that isn't really addressing your needs. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable. And you can even search by location, availability, and insurance. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it. I use this and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/vanished. ZocDoc.com/vanished. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, you'll have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I've been using Greenlight with my older two kids for years. One thing that I love about it is that I can set up recurring or one-time chores, customized to my family's needs, and then my kids earn an allowance to reward them for a job well done. Not only does it motivate them to actually get the chores done, but it also teaches them a bit about financial literacy and independence. They're learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/vanished. That's greenlight.com/vanished to try Greenlight for free. One more time, that's greenlight.com/vanished. At a very young age, Kelsey's mom and dad divorced, and her mother, Sarah, married a man who we will call Jeff. Sarah was married to Jeff for several years, but the relationship was appallingly abusive, and Sarah and her children were physically, psychologically, and verbally abused, among other abusive behaviors at the hands of Jeff's violent and uncontrolled anger. Kelsey, her mother, and siblings escaped from their mother's abusive marriage. The family left their home and everything they knew, their friends, community, and support system. They left the vast majority of their material possessions and essentially all that was familiar to them because of the severity of the threat that the abuser posed to their safety. Sarah explained what was going on after she and her husband divorced, but before she was able to escape the grip he held on the family.
He kept one of my kids with him all the time. I had moved to Michigan, and he kept trading off kids that he would take. It was usually my older two. so that I wouldn't go anywhere. And he'd have tabs on me. And my niece was trying to get a hold of my oldest daughter because they were similar ages and hadn't been able to get a hold of her. And she came to visit and she wasn't there. And she went to my mom and dad, and my mom and dad found out she hadn't been going to school. And they called me and they said, "You may be afraid of them, but we're not." They said, "We're going to report her as kidnapped to the FBI if we don't see her by midnight." And I called them and I said, "My mom and dad are going to report you as a kidnapper." And he put her on a plane.
Sarah told us about their escape after she had all of her children back with her, and she didn't know what her abuser might do next.
We packed up almost nothing. I took a pair of shoes, a pair of sandals, a pair of shorts, and a pair of jeans for each of the kids, and a pack of toilet paper, and I had $500 in the bank, and I left in the middle of the night. My sister had given me her sister-in-law's phone number and said, "If you ever need to get away, she will help you." So we drove and spent the night in a skate park, and I called her at 7 a.m. and she drove us to a different state, and she knew somebody in a domestic violence shelter that started the process rolling. And we literally had nothing. I had a 13-year-old car and 4 kids. I was 41, so I basically started my entire life over at 41.
The Collins family went to the state of Washington, one of 18 states that we learned allows for legal name changes to be made under a sealed court order when there is a reasonable concern for safety. According to the Operation Safe Escape website, there are currently 18 states that allow for sealed court-ordered name changes of survivors of domestic violence. Washington is one of those states, with precedent-setting laws that were established in 1979, long before domestic violence was a national conversation. Those laws were updated in 2015 in accordance with societal evolving standards of decency and remain a national benchmark for other states looking to protect victims of family violence. We don't usually bore you by reading laws, but what was written into statute is of particular interest and demonstrates how serious domestic violence is. So we wanted to share an abbreviated version with you. The legislature finds that there are a wide range of consequences to domestic violence, including deaths, injuries, hospitalizations, homelessness, employment problems, property damage, and lifelong physical and psychological impacts on victims and their children. These impacts also affect victims' friends and families, neighbors, employers, landlords, law enforcement, the courts, and the healthcare system, and Washington State and society as a whole. Advocacy and shelters for victims of domestic violence are essential to provide support to victims in preventing further abuse and to help victims assess and plan for their immediate and longer-term safety, including finding long-range alternative living situations if requested. These laws were not all in place at the time Kelsey's family made their escape in the late 90s, but the seeds planted by earlier legislation provided them the safe haven of protected housing, counseling, social services, and many other valuable resources that many people don't consider when thinking about the challenges that someone faces when they attempt to escape a violent and often lethal relationship. In fact, these challenges are known best by those who remain stuck in an abusive relationship and are significant obstacles to saving and rescuing those who are trapped. When we were producing Kelsey's story, we wanted to ensure that the light of her life shined through and wasn't overshadowed by this aspect of the story. But we realize that this is crucial to telling the entire story of who Kelsey is and what happened to her. Because as we realized in listening to Sarah's words, this is Kelsey's story, and these events that occurred at crucial points in her childhood set the stage for what would happen to her later, the choices she would make, and the people she surrounded herself with.
That's why we came to Washington. There's a law in the books that if you enter Washington because of domestic violence, you can automatically become a resident because all the things for changing your names require residencies. And so as soon as you cross Washington borders, you can become a resident and then you can legally get your name changed. Ours actually was sealed. Even if it wasn't sealed, you have to know where the person changed their name. So you have to have tracked them down to a place that they stayed long enough to take it. And even though that's what happened in Washington, it still took us 11 months to get all of that taken care of. New Social Security numbers and name changes, and that all took 11 months before it was all complete.
A change of Social Security numbers is exceedingly rare, and the Social Security Administration does not agree to it, even in the face of a court order, except in the most extreme cases. So what Sarah told us next gave us all we needed to know about how bad the situation they narrowly escaped with their lives was.
So we stayed in domestic violence shelters, and that was what he threatened me with, was, I know your Social Security number, I will find you anywhere. And they changed it. Like I said, it took us 11 months from the time we crossed the border of Washington to get that done. I felt like somebody believed how bad it was. I didn't think my family understood how bad it was. They do now, but my girls went back 8 years later and the prosecutor put him in jail for, it was supposed to be for 20 years, but they let him out in 2020 and he found two more little girls and raped them. And they found out and they put him back in jail and now he's facing two more charges.
We just recently learned from Sarah that the man who so violently abused her family has been convicted again of the charges she mentioned. This made their flight to freedom all the more palpable and poignant, as we continued to listen to Sarah share their harrowing story.
We came to Washington, we changed our names. That's why I still call her Emily, because that was her birth name. And when we changed our names, we decided that one way to keep a little piece of us was to use our first names as our middle names. And I know lots of people who go by their middle name. You know, maybe they were juniors. My brother-in-law always went by Paul, even though his first name was Robert, because his dad's name was Robert, and he didn't want anything to do with his dad. And there's just lots of people that go by their middle names for whatever reason. And so people would say, well, why are you calling her Emily? And I'm like, oh, well, that's her middle name. And we call, you know, our family uses the middle names a lot. And it's an easy explanation. And it doesn't get questioned.
As we continue to move through the story, you may hear Kelsey referred to as Emily. And this is why. Her legal name after the name change was Kelsey Emily Collins. And while the public knows her as Kelsey, close relatives still referred to her as Emily. We want to hit rewind once more on Kelsey's life and go back to her early childhood. When Kelsey was born, Sarah already had two daughters, Dominique, who was 9, and Mariah, who was 5. Dominique remembers Kelsey's birth vividly and that she was always the little sister who wanted to be as close as Dominique and Mariah were to each other.
I remember her. She always loved to sing. She was happy and she was loving. And then my memory kind of flickers in and out when I hit 12 and 13. And a lot of that was due to when my mom met my stepdad. And there was just a lot going on. So that's when I start to kind of flicker back and forth. I was also more closer with my sister, Mariah. So her and I were, you know, we were only 3 years apart. So her and I were a lot more closer than, you know, Kelsey was a baby. She was like 2 and I was 12. And I was like, I don't know what to do with a 2-year-old other than watch her. And that's really what I did. I babysat. It's just a general way of putting that. And that's just kind of what it was. And that's really what I remember doing. I know my mom worked a lot. You know, I know my dad did not. you know, Kelsey was, you know, the baby.
Sarah was still married to Kelsey and her sister's father. But even before Kelsey's birth, the marriage wasn't a happy one. And then, unexpectedly, Kelsey came along. Sarah told us about the earliest parts of Kelsey's life, from before she was even born.
She was an unplanned pregnancy, and I had real hesitation. I didn't want to bring another child into my horrible marriage. It wasn't that I didn't want another child. It was that my marriage was so bad because my ex-husband, the girl's dad, is an alcoholic. And he was kind of really in some of his worst times. When she was born, she wouldn't feed. And she kept spitting up this yellow stuff. And I saw this petechiae on her arms. And I used to work in cytogenetics. And one of the signs of congenital leukemia is petechiae. And so I didn't want to tell anybody because I didn't want to be right. But I couldn't get her to really eat. And finally, I told one of the nurses, this is my third child. I know how to do this. It's not that I don't know how. Like, she is not eating. She saw some of the spit up on one of the, on, you know, the bib or whatever that they had given us. And she goes, is she throwing this up? I said, yes. And she goes, okay, I'll be right back. And from there, they went and got a neonatologist and they took her up to NICU. And they didn't really know what was wrong with her. They had a couple of guesses. They thought she might have necrotizing enterocolitis. They thought it was possible she had Hirschsprung's. It could have been an infection. But so she was in the NICU a total of 30 days. And they came in and did a lot of tests. And the gastroenterologist, they said, no, she's not acting like Hirschsprung's at all. The pathologist that I actually worked for at the time said, I'm sending the slides to one of my best friends that I trust, and I don't see any neurons in her biopsy, but I want to make sure somebody else looks at them. And so he got back to me a few days later, and he said, no, she has Hirschsprung's. She needs surgery. And then the gastroenterologist kept arguing with the pathologist. They actually discharged her. I didn't get to hold her. Once they put her in NICU, I didn't get to hold her for another 10 days.
If Sarah sounds like she's more than a mom in this situation, it's because she is. She works in healthcare as a geneticist and research scientist. This made her even more aware of how serious her infant daughter's health concerns were, but also frustrated that answers didn't come right away. In addition to that, Kelsey's dad wasn't a source of support and didn't seem to share Sarah's grave concerns.
My husband at the time didn't handle it well at all. He doesn't like hospitals. He came into the NICU once. He was rip-roaring drunk. These are people I work with. I am so embarrassed. I'm like, I can't believe you came in here like this. And, you know, he just didn't even notice it, basically. That is really the only time I can remember him coming into the hospital the whole time she was there. You know, when they finally let us hold her, he came in and was drunk. And that he didn't come back until we were discharged. And they discharged her and they said, she seems to be doing well. This is probably just maybe going to be a chronic problem, but we don't really know what's going on.
At this point, the family still didn't have answers, but it was clear that Kelsey couldn't be left home all day with a babysitter or sent to a standard daycare facility. For a time, her dad stood up to the task of changing jobs, taking on a different job and being a full-time dad to Kelsey, as well as her older sisters.
I had been looking for somebody to take care of her, and I knew that I wasn't going to be able to just put her in a daycare. You know, she had just come out of NICU. So my husband was working in a factory. It was a long commute.
and he wasn't making that much money. And I said, I think the best solution is for you to watch her, because it's going to take your entire salary to find somebody who will watch her, knowing that she has problems going on. And so he did. I finished out my maternity leave, and then he quit his job and stayed home to take care of her. And he ended up getting a job at one of the local bakeries that was super early morning deliveries, so that I was home. And he would only work, you know, three or four hours delivering stuff, and then he'd be home the rest of the day. I'd go to work and take the girls to school. He would call me whenever things didn't seem right to him. And I lost count of how many times we took her to the emergency room. She got RSV. She got C. difficile infection. She was about 3.5 months old, and my husband called me and he said, she won't take her bottle and she's screaming and she won't stop. So I said, meet me at the emergency room. And we were in the emergency room for a long time. We had an appointment at Cleveland Clinic later in the week. And he said, well, we're going to cancel that. She actually does have Hirschsprung's, and she's got to have surgery. And it was kind of like, didn't the pathologist tell you this 2.5 months ago? So she had to have emergency surgery. They had to intubate her or put a nasal gastric tube to try to get rid of some of the blocked gas that was inflating her bowel. Then they gave her a colostomy, and she had the colostomy for, she was 3.5 months, and she got it reversed when she was about 13 months. And that's when she got the C. difficile. Again, we were always back in the emergency room. By that time, they had gotten a new partner in the GI practice, and he was great. He took one look at her and he said, no. He said, next time, just call me. I'll admit her. You don't even have to go through the emergency room.
Those early years were a roller coaster ride for Kelsey and her family. But ultimately, Kelsey was able to have the surgery that would give her a normal life, without the health risks and burdens of having to start school without being able to use the restroom like other children. But Kelsey's life was never what most people would consider normal. And there may have been psychological effects of the medical traumas she endured in infancy and throughout early childhood. Even though her medical challenges were able to be successfully addressed and she recovered, Dominique remembers the early parts of Kelsey's life from a child's perspective, which is completely different and unique from Sarah's as a mother and healthcare specialist.
My mother's memory is way more vast than mine is. I think that that's a lot with, I've compartmentalized a lot, and sometimes it's hard for me to dig deep into those sections, but from what I remember of Kelsey being younger was she was a happy baby. I do know that. I remember there were so many complications. And as a child, I didn't understand a lot of them. I didn't understand my mom and my parents, my dad being gone a lot of the time. Like, you get the concept of somebody's in the hospital, but you don't really, as a kid, you don't really understand that. You're just kind of like, oh, okay, we're going to grandma's house, or oh, okay, grandma and grandpa are coming over to watch us again, you know, things along those lines. Because my mom and my dad were in the hospital a lot with her. You know, I remember having to change the colostomy bag. That's actually a memory that sticks out quite a bit. And part of that was because, you know, my dad was an alcoholic. And so there were many days where when I got home from school, I was the babysitter. And that's just the reality of what that was.
During this time, after Kelsey had her colostomy reversed, Kelsey still struggled with health complications, but was too young to fully understand why things that other people could have would make her so sick.
Shinny was not as tall as, you know, Dominique is real tall, but very, very thin. Kelsey took after my family. We have never missed meals, and we look like we've never missed meals. She was just kind of chunky all the time. Even when she was like, we couldn't get her over 20 pounds. She had to be 20 pounds to have the reversal surgery. And we couldn't get her over 20 pounds. She'd get to like 19 and a half and then she'd get sick. And they finally said, you know what, we're going to do it anyways. But once she had that reversed, she just ate everything. And there were things that she really couldn't tolerate because they had taken out quite a bit of her bowel. And it was always the things that she loved. She couldn't have orange juice at all. She loved zucchini. She could have like one or two tiny slices of zucchini, but she wanted to eat the whole pan. Tomato sauce. So spaghetti was, you know, I mean, it's a staple, right? She couldn't eat the sauce. Chocolate was hard for her. And she found a stash of frozen Thin Mint Girl Scout cookies in the freezer. And I came in and the wrappers were on the floor and there was like one cookie left. And she was sick for days. But you kind of learned what her stomach was sensitive to. After she got her reversal, the first babysitter I tried her in, she was about 18 months. And she did not talk very much. She had about four words. And it was mama, up, more, and bye. And that's all she would say. Mostly, she would point and scream at things. And her sisters would bring objects over to her until it was the one she wanted.
Sarah wasn't sure if Kelsey would fall into typical childhood development and grow out of the medical problems that had cast a shadow over her since birth. But she felt immense guilt that she had somehow brought this onto Kelsey. But eventually, the family settled into what they knew as normal and hoped it would remain that way.
When she got sick, I had a huge guilt factor because I'm like, God is paying me back for not wanting this baby. This is why she's so sick. That took a long time to go away. Once she got everything reconnected and I found one babysitter, and that lasted about 2 months. And she said, she doesn't talk. I don't know what she needs. So I had to scramble. And I actually found a wonderful woman who had moved into the community recently. She had three little girls. One was close to Emily's age.
This would be the family's life until they fled from Sarah's second husband in the later part of the 90s. After several years of starting over, adjusting to another so-called normal, and figuring out what a new life looked like, it seemed like there was a lot of hope and good ahead for Kelsey. And Sarah told us what really brought her personality to life and interested her as she got older.
She liked to sing, and she liked to dance, and she liked to play outside a lot, mostly singing though. You know, she went to kindergarten. Her kindergarten teacher came up to me and said, she just shines when she starts to sing. And she was always like that. She wanted to try out for American Idol. And they came to Seattle and she was 15. And you had to be 16 to try out. And she had spent months singing the same song through the house the whole time. And then she found out she was too young. She was just devastated. She started in her elementary school was a K through 8. And so when she was in 6th or 7th grade, she started a stomp class. Stomp teams are things that you see in primarily black colleges. And that's what she was really into, stomping. And she asked if she could start a stomp club at her elementary school, and she did. We went down to Seattle Center, and they had a little thing with some other stomp teams from the area, and, you know, she loved it.
The Vanished is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up after the winter, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. It's a good time to think about the right amount of socializing for you. Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you prefer more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. A therapist can help you learn how to set boundaries so you feel empowered to be the best version of yourself. Everyone can benefit from therapy. It's not just for those who've experienced major trauma. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/vanished today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/vanished.
Everyone knows that finding the perfect t-shirt can be a challenge. I've always had problems, whether it was with the fit or quality. Luckily, the perfect t-shirt does exist, and you can find it at Skims. From cropped silhouettes to long-sleeve layering tees, there's a style for everyone. You know that I've been wearing Skims for a long time, and recently tried one of their t-shirts. It's the best-fitting tee I've ever worn. Skims makes the best basics and foundations. I got the boyfriend t-shirt in Onyx, and it's so soft and comfortable. I want to wear it every day. It literally fits like a dream. Shop the Skims t-shirt shop at skims.com, now available in sizes extra, extra small to 4X. If you haven't yet, be sure to let them know I sent you. After you place your order, select podcast in the survey and select my show in the drop-down menu that follows. At this point in Kelsey's life, Dominique was a young adult, so she wasn't around as much, and she shared with us why, and what she remembers about what was going on in Kelsey's life around this time.
So once we left my stepdad, I completely rebelled. So I was not home a lot. And I mean, I was, from the time I was 16 to the time I was 19, I was just in and out, in and out, in and out. My brother, my sister, both my sisters were at home a lot. I know that Kelsey went to school. I know that she had a learning disability, but she was still really, really sweet, but she was also extremely headstrong. So she did not like to listen when my mom wasn't around. So we fought a lot. Because I was the oldest, I also took charge a lot. And I was like, you guys, this house is a mess. Let's clean it up. You know, we cooked dinner a lot by ourselves. Kelsey spent a lot of times with our neighbors, like our, because, you know, you live in an apartment complex. So we knew a lot of our neighbors. And so she'd be down there a lot playing with kids. She was great, great with children, younger kids.
Sarah told us that she also remembers Kelsey's big heart and passion for helping others.
She was actually very compassionate, empathetic, I guess maybe is a better word, to older people that used to live in our apartment building. Like, she would go up and check and see if they needed their trash taken out or if they needed help getting their groceries up. We lived on the third floor of an apartment building. She would ask people in the building, you know, that were getting elderly if they needed help with their groceries or they needed their trash taken out. And she would do it for them. And I'm sure sometimes it was a way to get a dollar or two so she could go spend it at the, you know, 7-Eleven. But she just liked doing it for people.
Despite the positive aspects and potential for so much, Kelsey's new life was still fraught with struggle. The family was alone, far away from their relatives, and Kelsey was too young to understand the severity of the abuse the family had endured fully as she grew up. But she did know that for several years, they had no contact with their extended family. And then Sarah told us that several years in, they had to confront their abuser again, just as the wounds were really starting to heal, and roots had been planted that were growing into new lives in the Pacific Northwest. Undoubtedly, this had an effect on Kelsey.
We didn't have real contact with my family for close to 3 years. An occasional phone call from a payphone. And I found out my dad had cancer. And I flew home. That was the first time they'd seen me in 3 years. I wore baseball caps and big giant sweatshirts and had a rental car. About 5 years after that is when my daughters pursued prosecuting them. And that actually happened because of a prosecutor that changed prosecutors. The first one, they had made the report to, didn't think there was a case. And a new one came into office and decided she didn't think he should get away with it. And she put her full force, flew us out, had the girls testify. I was on the list of witnesses in case they used our names that we were born with so that nobody would know who we had, quote unquote, become. He ended up doing a no contest plea and didn't want to. She wanted him to get 50 years. And I kind of convinced her that 20 was better than nothing, which was always a possibility if you take something to trial. And then they let him out early, and he did it again. So the same prosecutor has his case now. And I hope this will be his fourth felony.
We cannot even fathom what it must have been like for Kelsey to know that this was the man they had escaped from, who he was, and what vile crimes he had committed against his own family. Sarah told us that there was likely an even deeper impact, and that he continued to get married, commit violent crimes, and was accused and convicted of sexual assault of multiple minor children. Kelsey must have struggled with this immensely. There was another aspect of Kelsey's story where Dominique was able to provide us with a different glimpse of how affected Kelsey was, and told us that she struggled not just academically at school, but also to make friends. And she was also home with her younger brother, Nicholas, who was 5 years younger than Kelsey, while Mariah and Dominique had grown up. Dominique explained that while Kelsey silently struggled at school, Nicholas's behavior problems may have caused Kelsey to be overlooked.
We were volatile with one another. And if I could extend to the circumstance that we were in, it was five people. And we were living in a two-bedroom apartment. Honestly, that's all my single mother, single mom could afford. And, you know, she did her absolute best, but we were all struggling not only within the household, but we were all struggling mentally from the trauma that we had gone through, living essentially new lives, new names, everything. What I knew was that she had friends, but she was having a difficult time in school, getting to know people. She was really struggling with her classes and being social. There was a lot of strain when it came to my brother. He threw the most horrific tantrums. There would literally be three or four of us that would actually have to physically carry this kid down into the car. And again, it was almost as if Kelsey kind of got washed over. And I think because of that, because we were all in our own world, we were all severely traumatized, Kelsey, I think, navigated and started finding her own way.
As it turns out, finding her own way meant that as Kelsey's teenage years progressed, things would take a turn that reversed all of the success and progress the family had achieved since they started new lives. We will explore those troubled years as well as the innocence of youth in Kelsey next week. We know that she carried a heavy burden from so many different traumatic experiences, none of which were her fault or she asked for. And yet, when we asked Sarah to sum up her daughter, she told us this.
She was such an empathetic child. When the Seattle Times did an article on her, I had packed up her stuff in a couple of bins. And the lady, her name's Susan Kelleher, she's pretty amazing herself. She asked if she could look through some of it. And she opened one up and there's pictures of Care Bears from coloring books that she's colored in. And I said, she did those when she was in juvenile detention. And she started crying. She goes, oh my God, she was just a baby. She's coloring pictures of Care Bears. And, you know, that was, you could still see the heart of a child in her, even though she wanted to be all grown up. I don't know if I'd known earlier, if I'd been able to change anything. Because part of you as a parent is just angry that they've gotten themselves in these horrible situations. And then you get angry at the other people. And for me, I know I feel like I pushed her into testifying. And I looked at her and I said, do you want other girls to go through what you've gone through? And she said, no. And I said, then you need to testify and you need to tell them what happened. Because if nobody says anything, nothing will change. And then when she disappeared, I'm like, oh my God, it's my fault. Why did I convince her to do this? But I think she was a very brave teenager. I don't know if I could have done it when I was 17. And the other thing that they told me was she's getting ready to age out of the system because she was almost 18. And I'm like, but this stuff didn't happen to her when she was 18. This is going on since she was 15 or 16 that you guys know of. That also sent me off on an anger spiel for a long time. Who cares what her age is now? You still have resources.
That brings us to the end of the first part of Kelsey's story. And we learned so many things that are vital to understanding what you will learn next week when we dig into the key players in her case. We covered a lot of Kelsey's life already, but in reality, we've only just scratched the surface of Kelsey's story. You know now that from birth, she struggled with medical problems. She was a victim of abuse at the hands of her stepfather. You know that she struggled in school with learning differences and delays. And while she had the potential to overcome these challenges, because she had already overcome so much, she was being chased, lured, and preyed upon by sick people who knew her weaknesses. Next week, you will hear about that tangled web of trouble that Kelsey seemed unable to escape. But we have to pose the question that lingered in our minds during the months we worked on this story. Kelsey knew how to start over. She watched her own family do it. She chose a new name for herself, created her own story, and this was before she was even 10 years old. Did she do it again at 18, armed with the knowledge that it was possible, before she was due to testify as a witness at a trial? Did she manage to escape the lurking threats of depraved and vile predators who would exploit a lifetime of vulnerability for personal gain? It's only on a very rare occasion that someone is able to obtain a completely new identity with a new name and social security number. Washington is one of the states that allows victims to change their name via court order filed under seal. You may remember the Bethany Tyner and Teresa Kennedy series we covered last year, and that in our follow-up to that series, we learned that Bethany and Teresa had gone to the state of Washington and legally changed their names, though to our knowledge, no other vital information was changed. In part two, we're going to delve into why she was testifying at a federal trial. Kelsey disappeared just 9 days after she became an adult. Why was she not in protective custody or being provided proper resources? How did all of this happen to someone who had only touched the tip of being an adult for a matter of days before she vanished? At the time of Kelsey's disappearance, she was 18 years old. She was approximately 5'6" tall and weighed around 150 pounds. She has brown curly hair that she sometimes straightens, and databases list her eye color as striking green. She has multiple surgical scars on her torso and a nose piercing. Kelsey is of mixed racial heritage and may appear racially ambiguous, though she is of Black, white, and Indigenous descent. On the night that she disappeared, she was wearing black, white, and red denim jeans, a pink top, and a black and red athletic jacket with black Jordan-branded sneakers. If you have any information about the disappearance of Kelsey Collins, you're asked to call the Everett Police Department at 425-257-8400 or the Seattle Police Department at 206-625-5011. If you or someone you love is struggling with mental health, we urge you to call or text 988, the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. If you or a loved one are the victim of intimate partner violence, please reach out to the National Domestic Violence Hotline at thehotline.org or via text by sending the word START to 88788. You may also call the hotline 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at 1-800-799-SAFE. That's 1-800-799-7233.
been 13 and a half years, and no closer to me of them finding her. If anything, it often feels like they've just put her on a shelf and they're waiting for something to magically appear. It's hard to imagine, and yet here I am living it. I think she's in the area. I think she's in the Seattle area. I've often dreamt that she's underwater, but there's a lot of water around here. They've also never found an old Cadillac, and they've never found that car. It disappeared. I have seen her be in that car, but I didn't see her go in that car that night. But their car disappeared. No one's been able to find it. They did actually look for it quite hard. I think they might have drove it off into a body of water. And there's a lot of body of waters. And a lot of them are deep enough that it would probably stay down for a very long time. I know they found, there's a little lake that's about 3 miles from my condo. A body just popped up like about a year ago. And it had been somebody who had been murdered 20 years earlier. It makes you wonder, there was a case, was actually one of the women who started Team Hope. Her little boy had been missing, I think, for 34 years. And they had always suspected somebody. And he got arrested, like, 34 years later for some child pornography charge. They made a deal with him. If he would tell them where the little boy was buried, he wouldn't be charged. And I was like, I don't want to have to wait 34 years. At this point, I think that's probably the only conclusion that I can rationally come to. But sometimes it's still very difficult not to have a hope that she's trapped somewhere or that she can't get away and has just become somebody else. One of the people, when we first came to Washington, we were in a transitional housing. A woman who lived next door to us, we've stayed in contact, and she said to me, and this had been years since she disappeared, she said, you taught her how to hide, and don't ever forget that, because she may still be hiding.
That brings us to the end of episode 377. I'd like to thank everyone who spoke with us for this story. If you have a missing loved one that you'd like to have featured on the show, there's a case submission form at thevanishedpodcast.com. If you'd like to join in on the discussion, there's a page and discussion group on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter at thevanishedpod and also on Instagram. If you like our show, please give us a 5-star rating and review. You can also support the show by contributing on Patreon. Be sure to tune in next week for the second part of Kelsey's story. Thanks for listening. Hey Prime members, you can listen to The Vanished ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.